Good evening to our U.S. diaspora listeners and good morning to our African listeners. Welcome to this special edition of Daybreak Africa's live coverage of the joint session of Congress. In about 30 minutes from now, President Donald Trump is set to address the joint session of Congress at the U.S. Capitol building, just a few hundred meters from our VOA headquarters here in Washington. I'm your host, James Butte, along with my co-host, Carol Van Dam. After President Trump delivers his speech, we will hear the response of the Democratic Party.
Joining us tonight is Todd Bell, professor and director of George Washington University School of Political Management. Kweke Nwama, he is professor in the School of International Service at American University. And Joe Slavik, a Republican strategist who is making his way into the studio. And also joining us here in the studio is White House correspondent Anita Powell. Thanks to you all for being here. But let's begin with VOA White House correspondent Anita Powell, who is following today's events and tonight's events.
Anita, good to have you here.
Thank you for letting me join you.
Well, let's start by telling us what's been happening today at the White House and Congress ahead of President Trump's speech. What sort of preparations have been underway?
Well, so it's been relatively quiet, dare I say, at the White House today, but we just have word now from the pool reporters who are with the president that they are that he and the First Lady are readying to depart the White House now for the drive to the Capitol. This is, of course, a motorcaded drive. This will be quite an event. It looks like he's leaving right now to go to this speech. So those are some of the, I mean, he's not being very visible all day, but we do have an interesting American tradition are the guests who sit in the First Lady's box or the first spouse's box during the speech. And those are an indication of how he intends to approach this speech today. A State of the Union address or a joint session, address before a joint session of Congress, which this technically is because it's not a State of the Union address, you know, goes over the president's accomplishments, lays out the president's agenda in front of lawmakers who hold the power of the purse, and then touches briefly on foreign policy, usually. Just to highlight the people that they're bringing into the First Lady's box tonight, there is a victim of computer-generated deepfakes. This is a personal project of the First Lady. There are survivors of the Comparatore family. This is the family whose patriarch was shot and killed, sadly, at the Butler, Pennsylvania rally on July 13th with President Trump. So this just gives us a sense of how he's going to approach this speech. He also is bringing a widow of an NYPD officer who, as they say, was murdered, their words, at a traffic stop in Queens by a repeat criminal who was allowed to roam the streets. That may be a signal that he is going to speak about immigration. Meanwhile, at the White House today, Trump surrogates have briefed journalists on what he intends to focus on. And so far, we can tell that immigration and also his push for government reorganization under the name of efficiency are going to be key pillars.
And the war in Ukraine has been dominated in the week. Did that come out at all today at the White House?
Right. So we are at a cliffhanger right now, I would say, on Ukraine after the very dramatic interaction between President Zelensky of Ukraine and President Trump and Vice President Vance in the Oval Office last Friday. Where we are now is we are hearing from President Zelensky that he is inclined to sign the preliminary, very broad minerals access deal with Donald Trump that President Trump says is a pillar of his involvement and of continued U.S. support to Ukraine. So that's where we are with Ukraine right now. And last night in the White House, President Trump did say that he would be speaking more about this tonight. So stay tuned.
I know. What other issues do you think the president might speak about tonight? Much has happened since the president was inaugurated.
It has indeed been a very busy 6 weeks with dozens and dozens of executive orders. So he is, of course, going to speak about immigration. That's what his surrogates say today. He is likely to speak about this government efficiency department, which is not an actual department, just to be clear, but the government efficiency push that is headed famously by Elon Musk, and also his policies. And he might also even bring up some of his executive orders that he believes fall under the umbrella of what he describes as common sense. Those are his orders on there being only two genders, according to executive order released on the first day of his presidency, and so on. Things that reflect, I think you could say, more traditional values. And so that's what we're expecting from the president. But as I said, Donald Trump may surprise us.
Anita, speaking of tradition, the opposition party in Congress gives a response to a presidential address before a joint session every time. And tonight we're going to be hearing from Elise Lotkin of Michigan. She'll be speaking on behalf of the Democratic Party. Has there been any indication of what she might do in the response?
Well, I think a lot of critics of Congress have noted that the Democratic opposition has been rather quiet. It's not clear what this junior senator from Michigan is going to say in her response. But of course, Democrats have been vocal about their opposition to Trump's punitive approach to immigration enforcement on those executive orders that emphasize, quote unquote, common sense. I'm talking about the one that establishes that there are only two genders, things like that. That's, of course, those are domestic issues. But I think another thing that is notable is Slotkin is bringing as a guest a Marine veteran who was sacked in this government efficiency push, a VA veteran. This is a person who works for the Department of Veterans Affairs. So she is likely to bring that up because I think it was really encapsulated by Elon Musk on the stage at CPAC wielding a chainsaw. This is the approach that the Department of Government Efficiency under Elon Musk believes that it is taking to the federal government. And I think what Slotkin is doing by bringing this person is showing the people who have been affected by that. And so it is possible, if she is bringing this guest, that she's going to touch on that issue and really voice the opposition, especially ahead of this critical continuing resolution budget vote that's coming later this month.
And there's something, as you know, called a designated survivor for events such as these very important events. What's that all about?
It's a rocking show with Christian Slater. No, I am joking.
Good one, Anita.
Okay, so the designated survivor is a cabinet member who is not invited to the speech. That's not because they're being rude, but because, God forbid, knock wood, in case anything were to happen to the many important American leaders who are gathered for this joint address. In this case, it's going to be all of the legislators minus one designated survivor, all of the Supreme Court justices, and then one cabinet member will be conspicuously absent. They don't usually announce it ahead of time. And so we will know who that is when we look at who is not there.
Well, that might take a few minutes to figure out.
Yeah, but this person is, of course, supposed to be the inheritor if, as I said, let's go back to the premise of the Christian Slater show. In that show, everybody at the Capitol in a horrific act of terrorism is killed and he becomes the president. That is the concept broadly. But of course, that would be a very terrible thing that nobody would like to see happen.
Yeah, I actually saw that episode. Pretty scary.
Yeah.
A little earlier, I spoke with Wendy Schiller, professor of public and international affairs at Brown University in the East Coast state of Rhode Island. She's also director of the Taubman Center for American Politics and Policy. She says that this is President Trump's big opportunity to speak not only to Congress, but directly to millions of Americans.
It sort of suggests that there is a message that needs to be sent not only inside of Congress, but outside to the voters. And typically, presidents have used this opportunity after they're elected, before a formal State of the Union, because they haven't been president long enough to really comment on the State of the Union under their presidency. They'll use this opportunity to sort of lay out their agenda, lay out their goals. I think this will be a victory lap for President Trump. Other presidents in the past, like Harry Truman, have used joint messages to Congress, in the 1940s, to lay out the United States' position on communism and tell the world what the United States would do. This was about Greece and Turkey, but really extended to the rise of the Soviet Union. So they can be monumentally important in the history of the United States in setting the direction for policy.
What issues does the president usually cover in this address? Like, not talking about, like, you put it in perspective at that time in our history about, you know, Turkey and Greece, but what are the types of, like, the economy, how it's doing, right, and other things that Americans in particular are interested in?
Well, we can think back to Franklin Delano Roosevelt, and he gave both joint addresses to Congress, but he also gave fireside chats to update the American people on the state of the economy. And that's what's so important to remember, is that the tools for communication by the president to reach voters directly, individually, have expanded, you know, from radio to television, and then now, of course, to social media. So the need to get the attention of a joint session of Congress is not as great to reach the American voter. But if you are a president and you want to pressure Congress into passing your agenda, you want to take it to them. You want to go inside their chamber, inside their House and Senate, and say, give me A, B, and C, and have the American people watch the reaction. And that's what Trump is doing this week. And that's what President Trump will want to do in case Republicans start to waver on some of the actions that the Trump administration has already taken.
And it seems like as the years go by, this event has become more and more theatrical. Would you not agree?
I have to disagree that it's more theatrical than it's ever been. I mean, certainly Harry Truman, and I play this speech for my students in class. Harry Truman's speech was very theatrical. He was very animated. This was really announcing basically the Truman Doctrine, that the United States would fight communism wherever it appeared on the planet. So that was a fairly pomp and circumstance kind of speech. And certainly when you think about Obamacare, President Obama sort of trying to go get the Congress to pass Obamacare, I think that this is not, it's sort of par for the course. But again, there's several audiences. It's the American public, it's Congress, but so the Republican majority in Congress has been very loyal to the president so far verbally. But now they're going to have to pass a new budget in less than a month to keep the government open. They're starting to hear from their constituents about some of the cuts, the Veterans Administration, for example, and cuts in foreign aid and cuts certainly in healthcare research. And they have to have a response. And so this is an opportunity for President Trump to pressure them into sticking with him and some of these really more large spread cuts.
I know it's kind of a technicality, but what's the difference between a joint session of Congress and a State of the Union address in the United States?
In the United States Constitution, there is an obligation written into the Constitution that the president shall, from time to time, give Congress a message as to the State of the Union. So the speech itself became titled State of the Union directly from the language of the Constitution, but it was never formalized. In fact, you know, I think John Adams gave it in person and Thomas Jefferson did once maybe and then decided, no, I can just write you a letter. And it didn't become formal again until Woodrow Wilson in the beginning of the 20th century. You can understand that the rise of technology made it a more attractive proposition for a president to give the State of the Union to the Congress when it could be over radio and then television and now, of course, live streamed over all sorts of channels.
That was Wendy Schiller. She's professor of public and international affairs at Brown University. She was speaking with me yesterday from Providence, Rhode Island. Since 1913, presidents normally deliver a State of the Union address that gives an overview of the nation's priorities and achievements. As you just heard, when there is a new administration, the president's first speech to Congress isn't called a State of the Union address. The Speaker of the House, Mike Johnson, invited President Trump in January to address both houses of Congress.
And you're listening to a special Daybreak Africa program covering President Trump's address to a joint session of Congress. Joining us now by phone is Professor Kweku Nuama in the School of International Service at American University. Welcome to the show, Professor.
Thanks for having me, James.
Well, what are you expecting President Trump to focus on in his address?
Well, I'm expecting him to kind of talk about his agenda, but also to acknowledge the challenges that Americans are facing now. And I expect him to kind of reach out to the other side. He didn't win a landslide the way they've been acting as if they won this huge mandate. He only won 49% of the popular vote. So he's going to need Democrats to partner with him on a number of things, and it would be nice to see him reach out to them. I don't know if he's going to do it, but you know, generally this is his day, and he gets to set the tone. He gets to decide what he wants to talk about. Maybe he will acknowledge some of the challenges. Maybe he will talk about the achievements so far. And some of those achievements are debatable because he's probably going to talk about tariffs and he's going to talk about the work of DOGE. People who have been fired don't see that as an achievement. And some of those people are probably going to be in their audience. And hopefully he exercises some humanity towards them rather than rub it in the fact that people have lost jobs. This is not something that you you should hail as an achievement. But we you know, he's unpredictable, so we are all waiting to see what he decides to go with.
Professor, sometimes important events like tonight can be overshadowed by major domestic and international events. For example, the Ukraine war, and just today, the new tariffs on Mexico, Canada, and China, that went into effect. Do you expect President Trump to talk about these?
Oh, yes. He's probably going to talk about them, but he's going to frame them as wins, which I'm not sure everybody shares. If you are a Trump supporter, you're probably going to see those as important wins. These are things that he campaigned on and he's delivered. But if you are not a Trump supporter or if you are an independent, you are going to see this as a head scratcher because he runs basically on cutting costs and controlling inflation. But we haven't seen that. We've seen prices go up. And his chaotic tariffs is actually destroying the stock market. People are losing their savings. And so there's a lot of pain in this country. He's not delivered on the big things that he promised. And so hopefully he exercises some humility. But he's going to talk about them. He's going to talk about this stuff because that's what Donald Trump does. He understands how television works. And make no mistake, this is a television moment. He's reaching out to an audience beyond the people in the room. And so he's going to try and frame the narrative as this is victory, this is making America strong, and this is what I promised, and I'm delivering on that. So he's going to count this as a win.
Now, Professor, the freezing of USAID assistance has impacted many countries around the world, especially in Africa. Could you explain why this issue is very important to people in Africa and why many Africans might be listening intently to President Trump's speech?
Well, the United States is the number one provider of aid to a lot of countries around the world, as you said, Africa itself. And so, but again, it's not just important to Africans and the recipients. It's also important to America's sense of leadership. And American soft power comes out of the work that USAID does. This is very important work. He's cutting this because it's easy to do. It's easy to do this, and it's easy to say we're saving money by you know, cutting unnecessarily without looking into the details of what the kind of work that people do in USAID. I think in the end, it's going to hurt the United States more than it helps because I don't think they're saving a lot of money. The USAID budget is only 1% of the federal budget, so they're not saving a whole lot of money here. But that 1% means a lot to people in Africa who are dependent on support for HIV/AIDS, medicine, for example, or food and all those things. And so it's just taking saving a little money. That will cause a lot of pain. I think that in the end, this is going to hurt the United States' standing in the world. I hope that they find a way back to restoring aid, particularly aid that's been cut to multilateral institutions. Those things are important. And hopefully, you don't cut everything. You look at it and you see where there's waste that can be trimmed. But there are important, important programs that need to be funded. And I just hope that as things settle down, he finds his way back to restoring that funding.
Of course, we've heard from the president and from the Department of Government Efficiency, DOGE, as it's called, that, the reason that they're doing this is that they believe that there could be people that are claiming they're going to work and they're not even going to work. And, you know, that's got to be thrashed out. But I just wanted to get that in there because that's the other side of it. But thanks, Professor Nuwama. Let's turn to Todd Belt, professor and director of George Washington University School of Political Management. Todd, what issues are you expecting President Trump to emphasize in his address?
Well, good evening. It's good to be with you, and greetings to you and all of your listeners and viewers tonight. I certainly expect DOGE to be one of the key things that Donald Trump needs to talk about. He's going to try to turn the problems that DOGE has had with some of the mislabeling of the mislabeling of the amount of savings that they have had on their website, which they had to take down. Also, the issues with employment, as your previous guest said, he's going to try to change the narrative. And I think the way he's going to do this is there's been a lot of talk about DOGE benefit checks going out to taxpayers. And I think that, you know, this was an idea that first came up by George W. Bush back when he did his first tax cut in 2001. And of course, we had the stimulus checks during COVID. And I think this is a way for Donald Trump to sign his name again on something that he's giving back to the American people, which will also help to quantify for people that this action is being done in the name of American taxpayers and not just merely at the expense of jobs of others. And of course, we'll hear a lot about everything that he's done in office, and you know, he'll claim how much he has done more than any other president. He loves that sort of hyperbole. And I think that he'll talk about what I think are four key foreign policy issues, even though usually in these speeches, most of what you're going to hear is domestic policy. Mm-hmm. Certainly, Trump does need to talk about what's going on with Ukraine and Russia. He will talk about Israel. He will talk about his approach to China as well, because this is, of course, a big issue for him and always was during his first term, and he wasn't able to consummate that deal that he wanted during his first term. And then finally, the issue of fentanyl, immigration, and the tariffs on our border countries, Canada and Mexico, which, of course, just went back into effect. And he's going to have to defend them and speak to the American people and be the explainer in chief tonight about why he thinks that these are a benefit in the long run for American people.
You know, he still has a very, very strong base and people that believe what he's doing so far with a lot of the changes he's made already is the right thing. But he's going to be talking to all Americans tonight. So what does he need to achieve tonight?
Well, that's absolutely the case. There are two things that Donald Trump really likes to pay attention to in order to determine how well he's doing. And of course, the first is his job approval numbers, which have been slipping and they are below where any other president has been in their first term. In their first couple months, and so he's concerned about that. And then, of course, the stock market. That's another thing that he really uses as a ruler to measure how his success is. And the stock market's been tumbling on the news of the tariffs and the types of things that have been going on. So he's going to try to tell Americans that, you know, what he's doing is in their interest. It'll make America wealthier and it'll make everybody have more money in their pockets in the long run to stick with what he's doing.
We mentioned that we're going to hear from this first term Senator Elise Slotkin. What do you think Democrats will focus on in their response being delivered by her tonight?
Yeah, one of your reporters earlier talked about the disarray of the Democrats. I mean, they really had no plan to deal with this shock and awe approach of the president with his whirlwind of activity. The Democrats don't have many levers of power. They have, you know, the governorships and legislatures of some states, which can bring court cases. And of course, there's the judiciary. So we've seen what a lot of things that Donald Trump has tried to do have been knocked down by the courts. And what Democrats want to tell to Americans, not just Democrats, but also independents who are wondering, what are they doing standing on the sidelines while this is all going on, is what is their plan and what do they intend to do? And what would an America under Democratic leadership look like in a different way?
So these presidential speeches to Congress are usually the time for a president to recite accomplishments, like you say, of the past year, when there is a past year, give an update on the economy, mm-hmm. foreign affairs, present new proposals. President Trump has only been in office for just over a month, but he's issued scores of executive orders, and you've made reference to that, and making some pretty big policy changes. What do you think the president will showcase tonight specifically as his successes?
Yeah, and don't forget that we also usually get a big surprise in one of these speeches, too.
Yep.
Like we're going to Mars, or the Department of Homeland Security is going to be put together, or something like that. So I anticipate there will be a surprise, but I think that some of the most the things that Donald Trump is going to crow about the most certainly is immigration. That is his big issue, and he's going to talk about how many people have been deported. He's going to talk about how this is going to make America a stronger country, making deals with our border neighbors in order to increase the activity in terms of border enforcement. He'll probably say the American border is closed or something along those lines, something a little bit hyperbolic like that. And I think that those are that is his key issue. Remember when he first came down that escalator in Trump Tower, that was the thing that he talked about the most. That has always been his key issue. Build the wall has always been the chant that gets the biggest crowd approval at his rallies. So I think we might hear more about building the wall as well, in addition to these other things to try to change the narrative on DOGE. And remember, other than the dozens of executive orders that he issued, just one of them undid over 70 executive orders that that Joe Biden had done. So there's been a tremendous amount of activity. And I think that other than highlighting specific items, perhaps even birthright citizenship, he'll probably make a legal argument as to why he was right about that. I think he's also going to talk about the sheer volume of what he has done as being unlike anything ever done in history.
That is Todd Bell, professor and director of George Washington University's School of Political Management. Thanks, Todd. We've been watching on the monitors here. Several dignitaries have already entered the chamber. We've seen the diplomatic corps entering the House chamber. Speaker Mike Johnson is there up on the stage along with Vice President Vance. So they're all getting ready and set for the big entrance by the president himself. The Joint Chiefs have entered the House chamber, and I believe that the Second Lady, Usha Vance, has already been escorted into the executive gallery. And we're just keeping an eye on things for you here. We're expecting the president in about 10 or 15 minutes to start his speech.
And you're listening to a special Daybreak Africa program covering President Trump's address to a joint session of Congress. We asked reporter James Shimoyola in Nairobi, Kenya, to speak to people on the streets in advance of President Trump's address to the joint session about what they would like the U.S. to know about Africa.
This joint address to the Congress and the Senate, there is not much for African countries. There is a very aggressive stance on migrants, issuing tariffs. It's an unapologetic U.S. first. The U.S. has been decreasing its investments on the continent already. It's really not interested. I think one of the biggest blows that Trump will have is on climate change. If you look at the kind of climate financing that's been coming to the continent, it's very lopsided, and a lot of it is coming in the form of bond and loan that really extract majority of the profit and aren't necessarily doing much.
I would appeal to the president to give a favorable look to Africa, given that bilateral ties between the U.S. and the African countries have been robust for decades. Of late, we are not so sure about the Trump's administration has in store for the continent. I would appeal to President Trump to consider Africa as an ally, as a partner, landmark agreement that we have signed before with the United States, like the Africa Growth Opportunity Act. I would appeal to President Trump to give it a favorable look. Given the situation that we are in as a continent, I would appeal to the U.S. president to relook the issue of climate deal. This continent has borne the brunt of the climate crisis. Other areas that I would like the U.S. president also to prioritize is in the Eastern Democratic of Congo. That's a serious matter, and we fear that if it is not contained now, it might spill over to the entire region.
Trump should know that the cut of aid in Africa will stop corruption. It is time for Africa to establish its funding mechanism. It's also time for African countries to adopt aid policies. The policies will reduce aid dependency. I would like to remind President Trump that relations between United States and Africa have gone through the Cold War, the transitional period from 1990 to 1998, and the post-1998 period.
Our thanks to reporter James Shimanyula for gathering perspectives of those five Kenyans who spoke to us from Nairobi.
As we await President Trump to enter the joint session, Professor Nuoma, I have one more question that I'd like to ask you. Something that comes up during a joint session like this is the comportment of the other party. This time, the other party in opposition is the Democratic Party. What can you tell us about the history of how the other party behaves?
Well, we've seen instances where the other party has, kind of tried to disrupt the speaker. We saw it in Obama's term when a Republican congressman got up and said, "You lied," when Barack Obama was saying something. But usually the other party sits quietly. They just do not applaud when the president is speaking or bragging, and his side of the aisle, people are wildly cheering. If the president says something that is truly unifying or bipartisan, they may all stand up and cheer. So, for example, if he says something nice about the military, that's something that everybody likes to cheer. But generally, I think that it's bad form to disrupt a guest. And the president is a guest in the halls of Congress. When you invite somebody to your house, it's bad form to deny them the decorum that they deserve. Let them have their day. Let him speak, and then they'll have a chance to rebut. So if you disagree with something that he says after the speech, you go and make your speech. I don't think that you should take away from their moment by disrupting it. And if they try to do something like that tonight, Donald Trump likes that kind of stuff, and he's very good at it. He's very good at the theatrics of all of this stuff. So if Democrats try to do this stuff, I think it's going to backfire. They should just sit quietly. If they don't like what he's saying, do not clap, do not applaud. If you hear something that you like, applaud and stand up, especially if he goes in a bipartisan mode and he brings up the military or people who are suffering, that kind of stuff. You acknowledge that. And I think that you give him his moment, and then you go give your speech somewhere else. So I hope they don't do any kind of disruption, and I hope they just allow him to speak to the American people in a way that he's also the president, so he's the head of state. And so when you act in a disruptive manner, you are also not showing respect to the office. So that's important.
You know, Democrats that we have learned, who have spoken today, seem to be split on this. Like, some of them have said that they're boycotting the speech tonight. They're not even going to show up in the chamber. And other Democrats, led by Hakeem Jeffries, the Democratic leader, have said, no, we need to be in the room, and we need to make sure that the American people know how we feel about this. So, I mean, it's pretty much anybody's guess, right, how they are going to respond and if they're going to be, you know, very vocal or not.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that, I saw Cory Booker. Cory Booker said, "I'm going to go because this is part of America's institutions." And again, it's not just Donald Trump that's speaking. He's also the head of state, the president of the republic. And so he's there in his official capacity. So you show up and you show respect. It doesn't make you any less of a fighter for your people. Just show him the respect that you would expect the other side to show to a president from your side. And so you do that. I think that individual members of Congress are going to do what they want to do. Their leadership doesn't want any kind of disruption, because they need to take attention away from what they are trying to do as a party.
We're just seeing a lot of applause and hearing a lot of applause right now on the floor of the chamber. We have the First Lady Melania Trump being escorted to her box, and boy, is the place ever filling up now. I was going to just ask you one more quick question, if we can get it in before President Trump comes in. We've heard from the White House that he's expected to say he is overseeing the renewal of the American dream. He's going to trumpet his economic plans, and he's going to push for Congress to pass additional funding for border security. Do you think that's going to go over well with most Americans?
Well, if you have lost your job, if you can't find eggs to buy, if you lost your 401k because of the crash of the stock market, it's not a renewal of American dream, it's American nightmare. And so he needs to be aware of that, and he needs to show empathy towards people who are suffering. I know he has his billionaire friends around him, Elon Musk showing up with his chainsaw. Good for him. He's rich, but a lot of Americans are not rich, and they're looking for their president to help them solve problems. So he needs to be very aware. He needs to, you know, adopt a tone of empathy and some humility, because he's created a mess. And maybe people that voted for him like this, but a lot of people do not like it. And he needs to watch how independents in particular react towards his speech.
James, I'm seeing Secretary of State Marco Rubio coming in right now, shaking hands with lots and lots of Republicans on both sides of the aisle, and other cabinet secretaries making their way in. I haven't seen a glimpse yet of the president, but we're keeping an eye on things for you.
I see Kennedy also, Health and Human Services.
Yep.
And there is the Elon Musk is also coming in. The Doge, and that's the Defense Secretary.
Right, Secretary of Defense there, yeah. Hegseth, yep.
Professor, while we have you on, what we were talking about the behavior of the opposition party, there's a history here where as you mentioned, it's very important to treat the president when the president comes into your house. But there's a history in the last two presidents, Obama and Biden. How they talk about that, because there's a history.
Yeah, there's always going to be some heckling. It's not their general behavior. But yeah, there's a history of that. But there is another history here, too. Remember, Donald Trump is returning to a house that impeached him twice the last time, and a house where his supporters tried to kill people, stormed this house, tried to lynch his own vice president. So he's returning to the scene of his crime. And he pardoned all those people. There are people in that building that resent him for that. And so there's a lot of history. It's all loaded. But as I said, he's there not as Donald Trump. He's there as the president. So you respect the office. But at the same time, these are politicians. So they are also looking for their moments for television. If you are in the house, you know, if you get a little bit of exchange with the president, you go viral, you raise money off of that. All of a sudden, people know you around the country. This is how people build their careers in this country. Hopefully it doesn't get that ugly. Because if it gets ugly, Donald Trump knows how to fight ugly. I don't know if the Democrats want to give him that opportunity. Right now, he doesn't have a lot of accomplishments. And so he will like the combative exchange with a Democrat who stands up and says something that he can ridicule or insult or belittle in a way that will go viral. You don't want to give him that moment. Let him make his speech. Let him walk away. When he says something that's bipartisan, you stand up and you applaud. If he says something you don't like, you keep quiet. If he talks about the military, you stand up. If he acknowledges his wife, the first lady is always popular. If he acknowledges the first lady, you stand up and you clap. Those are the things. There's going to be some people there who have lost family members that are in there. You acknowledge those things. If he gets partisan, you keep quiet. You get your moment, but we never know what's going to happen. This is a live TV event, and all those politicians over there, they want to be on television. They want to go viral. This is how they raise money. It's how they win votes. It's how they telegraph their value to the people that send them here. So we are watching on television. They are communicating through their behavior to the people back home who elected them. And so something small, you know, can help you if you're a politician. All of a sudden, especially in the House, there's too many of them, and everybody's trying to break out of that anonymity. So this is what encourages people to misbehave. And the parties, the leadership should essentially, they are in whip positions, but you can't always whip this. So you can't control what everybody says.
You know, Professor, this is supposed to be his biggest audience, at least, for having the ears and the eyes of American people and the House and Senate lawmakers. But you know how things are today with all the fragmentation and all the different things people can listen to and watch with their devices. How many Americans do you think that there will be millions of Americans watching tonight?
I think so. I think people will tune in and maybe go off and do other things. But it's always important. That's not about Trump, is that this is a new president, but he's not a new president. He's a known quantity. We've seen him before. So, yeah, everybody knows what to expect, and people are going, and we know that he's not going to be presidential. When he got elected the second time, we thought that he was going to change, especially when he survived the assassination and all that stuff. But we've already seen him in a couple of months, and it's the same old Donald Trump, and he's actually worse. And so we've seen this act before. I'm going to watch it because I'm a polka junkie, but I understand if people just watch the opening and then move on to something else, and maybe they may tune back in with the analysis, because after the main event, then you have the spinning. So in the spin room, the people around the president will go on television and try and talk about what a wonderful speech it was, and the Democrats will have their rebuttal, and the Democrats will also appear on television shows and talk about what a terrible speech it was. This is a ritual in this town, and you know, everybody will watch this stuff. Few people's minds will be changed tonight. If you hate Trump, you probably will hate him more after this speech. If you love Trump, you probably will love him more. The people that matter are the independents who are in the middle, and that's what he needs to watch.
A lot of Americans voted for President, well, for Mr. Trump at that time, because they were worried about inflation and the price of food and other items going up so much, and they said that was their number one issue, along with border security. But I think that most said inflation and prices. And we've been watching how the New York Stock Exchange fell like hundreds of points today. Do you think that Americans are going to be, you know, watching what he says about the economy in particular?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Except that people are going to give him a little bit more time. He just got here. And a lot of the things that he blamed Biden for, and he said he was going to fix, it was clear that he was not going to be able to. He doesn't have a magic wand for fixing inflation. And there's this, you know, price of eggs going up. That's not his fault. But when you're president, you get a credit and you also get a blame. But I think we're still in the honeymoon period where people will wait a little bit. But eventually, if his tariffs are a self-inflicted wound. When people start losing their jobs, when prices start going through the roof because of tariffs, we already saw the reaction of the markets today. Then they will start blaming him. And so that's what he needs to start watching. Eventually, it will start hitting people in the pocketbooks, and even some of the people who voted for him, who are happy that he's firing federal workers because they think federal workers are creatures of Washington. They don't understand that 80% of the federal labor force is outside of Washington. They think these are woke people in Washington, D.C. who hate America, so fire them. USAID, they're giving American money to people who don't deserve to be supported. Fire them, that's all fine, until it starts affecting your pocketbook. And it will. Tariffs have a way of hitting the poorest people. So eventually, you know, around, if he doesn't walk back those tariffs, it's going to start affecting people. And then we'll see how the people that voted for him really, really like him.
You know, in fairness, I have heard some Republicans today and people with the White House say that the tariffs situation is just supposed to be, you know, kind of like a temporary thing, and it's supposed to be a switch, and you cannot, you know, threaten tariffs and then not follow through. So there's that.
That's true.
But
he doesn't control all of that.
No, that's true.
How the other countries react also determines how this ends. So Mexico is hitting back. Canada is hitting back. Then he gets himself in this tight spot where he has to hit back. He cannot walk away. Donald Trump is not going to back down from a fight. And so the fact that Mexico and Canada and China are responding is going to trap him into this war where he has to keep escalating.
Yeah.
He needs to find a way of declaring victory and then backing down.
James, keep an eye on the monitors for
Todd
me.
Belt,
let's talk to Todd.
Todd, is Todd still around? Todd, the issue of...
Thank
you very much. The issue of immigration dominated the campaign. What sort of report card do you think we are going to get?
Pardon us if we interrupt you, Todd, when you're answering, because now we're seeing Trump enter the room, President Trump. But you know, just keep talking until he gets up to the podium. Go ahead.
Sure. Donald Trump is going to say that this is the beginning. They're off to a great start, but that he needs the Congress to pass the budget to give him the resources he needs to finish the job.
Okay, thank you very much. That's Professor Todd Bell. James, you want to talk us up to, you can talk to us about what we're seeing right now.
Carol, as you said, President Trump has now entered the room, and he is shaking hands with members of Congress as he makes his way to the podium. Again,
you can see the Republicans just clamoring, you know, reaching over shoulders of other Republicans, trying to get their hand into the president's hand.
Of course, we are going to have analysis after the joint session of Congress and the Democrats' response. So we are waiting for President Trump now to take the podium.
And just to remind our listeners, this is very normal for the president to take his time going up to the podium and shaking lots of hands of his supporters. Especially, we're seeing some red hats of his supporters in the crowd there. And these are, remember, not just the lawmakers, but these are lots of friends of the lawmakers who have been invited into the chamber tonight for this historic speech.
As we said earlier, the Democrats have also brought special guests, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep, there's lots of special guests. Anita pointed out some of them. You know, a lot of people, I think, on the Democratic side at least, that are these guests are people who have lost their jobs in recent weeks because of the policy and the executive orders that, you know, were some of them had been let go because they were on probation and they could legitimately say, or the government said it's legitimate to let go of people who are on probation.
And we are going to hear from the president in terms of the progress and the impact of the DOGE headed by Elon Musk. This is the kind of report card that we are going to get from the president, how the president interprets the success of that program and other programs that he mentioned that he was going to implement during the campaign. So everyone will be listening. Americans will be listening. I'm sure also the international community, particularly because of the war in Ukraine, everyone is going to be listening to what the president says tonight. Mm-hmm.
And you mentioned Elon Musk, the head of Tesla, the head of several other companies, and the richest person in the world, worth more than $400 billion. We saw a glimpse of him a little bit earlier, and he is in a suit and tie tonight, unlike several times we've seen Elon Musk more recently.
And President Trump is talking to the justices of the Supreme Court. There are several cases before the Supreme Court coming up soon. Controversial cases. Uh-huh.
And we're cheering, chanting now of USA, USA. I think he's very, very close to the podium now, James.
It's probably going to be a competition of cheerleaders.
You could say that. Yeah, everybody wants to. The Republicans want to show their undying support. Here he is. He's coming up now. Taking one last kind of quick bow there before he steps up. He's shaking the hands now of Vice President J.D. Vance and the Speaker of the House.
Now he's at the podium.
Mike Johnson. Let's hear what the president has to say. Go to the chamber of the U.S. House of Representatives to hear the president's address.
Thank you very much. It's a great honor. Thank you very much. Speaker Johnson, Vice President Vance, the First Lady of the United States, members of the United States Congress, thank you very much. And to my fellow citizens, America is back. Six weeks ago, I stood beneath the dome of this Capitol and proclaimed the dawn of the golden age of America. From that moment on, it has been nothing but swift and unrelenting action to usher in the greatest and most successful era in the history of our country. We have accomplished more in 43 days than most administrations accomplished in 4 years or 8 years, and we are just getting started. Thank you. I return to this chamber tonight to report that America's momentum is back, our spirit is back, our pride is back, our confidence is back, and the American dream is surging bigger and better than ever before. The American dream is unstoppable, and our country is on the verge of a comeback, the likes of which the world has never witnessed and perhaps will never witness again. It's never been anything like it. The presidential election of November 5th was a mandate like has not been seen in many decades. We won all seven swing states, giving us an electoral college victory of 312 votes. We won the popular vote by big numbers and won counties in our country. Counties in our country, 2,700 to 525, on a map that reads almost completely red for Republican. Now, for the first time in modern history, more Americans believe that our country is headed in the right direction than the wrong direction. In fact, it's an astonishing record. 27-point swing, the most ever. Likewise, small business optimism saw its single largest one-month gain ever recorded, a 41-point jump.
Members are directed to uphold and maintain decorum in the House and to cease any further disruptions. That's your warning. Members are engaging in willful and continuing breach of decorum, and the chair is prepared to direct the sergeant-at-arms to restore order to the joint session. Mr. Green, take your seat. Take your seat, sir. Take your seat. Finding that members continue to engage in willful and concerted disruption of proper decorum, the chair now directs the sergeant-at-arms to restore order. Remove this gentleman from the chamber. Members are directed to uphold and maintain decorum in the House. Mr. President, you continue.
Thank you. Over the past 6 weeks, I have signed nearly 100 executive orders and taken more than 400 executive actions, a record, to restore common sense, safety, optimism, and wealth all across our wonderful land. The people elected me to do the job, and I'm doing it. In fact, it has been stated by many that the first month of our presidency, it's our presidency, is the most successful in the history of our nation. By many. And what makes it even more impressive is that, do you know who number two is? George Washington. How about that? How about that? I don't know about that list, but we'll take it. Within hours of taking the oath of office, I declared a national emergency on our southern border, and I deployed the U.S. military and Border Patrol to repel the invasion of our country. And what a job they've done. As a result, illegal border crossings last month were by far the lowest ever recorded, ever. They heard my words and they chose not to come. Much easier that way. In comparison, under Joe Biden, the worst president in American history, there were hundreds of thousands of illegal crossings a month, and virtually all of them, including murderers, drug dealers, gang members, and people from mental institutions and insane asylums, were released into our country. Who would want to do that? This is my fifth such speech to Congress. And once again, I look at the Democrats in front of me, and I realize there is absolutely nothing I can say to make them happy or to make them stand or smile or applaud. Nothing I can do. I could find a cure to the most devastating disease, a disease that would wipe out entire nations, or announce the answers to the greatest economy in history, or the stoppage of crime to the lowest levels ever recorded. And these people sitting right here will not clap, will not stand, and certainly will not cheer for these astronomical achievements. They won't do it, no matter what. Five times I've been up here. It's very sad, and it just shouldn't be this way. So Democrats sitting before me, for just this one night, why not join us in celebrating so many incredible wins for America? For the good of our nation, let's work together and let's truly make America great again. Every day, my administration is fighting to deliver the change America needs to bring a future that America deserves. And we're doing it. This is a time for big dreams and bold action. Upon taking office, I imposed an immediate freeze on all federal hiring, a freeze on all new federal regulations, and a freeze on all foreign aid. I terminated the ridiculous Green New Scam. I withdrew from the unfair Paris Climate Accord, which was costing us trillions of dollars that other countries were not paying. I withdrew from the corrupt World Health Organization. And I also withdrew from the anti-American UN Human Rights Council. We ended all of Biden's environmental restrictions that were making our country far less safe and totally unaffordable. And importantly, we ended the last administration's insane electric vehicle mandate, saving our auto workers and companies from economic destruction. To unshackle our economy, I have directed that for every one new regulation, 10 old regulations must be eliminated, just like I did in my very successful first day. And in that first term, we set records on ending unnecessary rules and regulations like no other president had done before. We ordered all federal workers to return to the office. They will either show up for work in person or be removed from their job. And we have ended weaponized government where, as an example, a sitting president is allowed to viciously prosecute his political opponent, like me. How did that work out? Not too good. Not too good. And I have stopped all government censorship and brought back free speech in America. It's back. And 2 days ago, I signed an order making English the official language of the United States of America. I renamed the Gulf of Mexico the Gulf of America. And likewise, I renamed, for a great president, William McKinley, Mount McKinley again. Beautiful Alaska. We love Alaska. We've ended the tyranny of so-called diversity, equity, and inclusion policies all across the entire federal government and, indeed, the private sector and our military. and our country will be woke no longer. We believe that whether you are a doctor, an accountant, a lawyer, or an air traffic controller, you should be hired and promoted based on skill and competence, not race or gender. Very important. You should be hired based on merit. And the Supreme Court, in a brave and very powerful decision, has allowed us to do so. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. We have removed the poison of critical race theory from our public schools, and I signed an order making it the official policy of the United States government that there are only two genders, male and female. I also signed an executive order to ban men from playing in women's sports. Three years ago, Peyton McNabb was an all-star high school athlete, one of the best, preparing for a future in college sports. But when her girls' volleyball match was invaded by a male, he smashed the ball so hard in Peyton's face, causing traumatic brain injury, partially paralyzing her right side and ending her athletic career. It was a shot like she's never seen before. She's never seen anything like it. Peyton is here tonight in the gallery, and Peyton, from now on, schools will kick the men off the girls' team, or they will lose all federal funding. Want to see numbers, just take a look at what happened in the women's boxing, weightlifting, track and field, swimming, or cycling, where a male recently finished a long-distance race 5 hours and 14 minutes ahead of a woman for a new record by 5 hours. Broke the record by 5 hours. It's demeaning for women, and it's very bad for our country. We're not going to put up with it any longer. What I have just described is only a small fraction of the common sense revolution that is now, because of us, sweeping the entire world. Common sense has become a common theme, and we will never go back. Never. Never going to let that happen. Among my very highest priorities is to rescue our economy and get dramatic and immediate relief to working families. As you know, we inherited from the last administration an economic catastrophe and an inflation nightmare. Their policies drove up energy prices, pushed up grocery costs, and drove the necessities of life out of reach for millions and millions of Americans. They've never had anything like it. We suffered the worst inflation in 48 years, but perhaps even in the history of our country. They're not sure. As president, I'm fighting every day to reverse this damage and make America affordable again. Joe Biden especially let the price of eggs get out of control. The egg price is out of control, and we're working hard to get it back down. Secretary, do a good job on that. You inherited a total mess from the previous administration. Do a good job. A major focus of our fight to defeat inflation is rapidly reducing the cost of energy. The previous administration cut the number of new oil and gas leases by 95%, slowed pipeline construction to a halt, and closed more than 100 power plants. We are opening up many of those power plants right now. And frankly, we have never seen anything like it. That's why on my first day in office, I declared a national energy emergency. As you've heard me say many times, we have more liquid gold under our feet than any nation on Earth, and by far. And now I fully authorize the most talented team ever assembled to go and get it. It's called Drill, Baby, Drill. My administration is also working on a gigantic natural gas pipeline in Alaska, among the largest in the world, where Japan, South Korea, and other nations want to be our partner with investments of trillions of dollars each. There's never been anything like that one. It will be truly spectacular. It's all set to go. The permitting is gotten. And later this week, I will also take historic action to dramatically expand production of critical minerals and rare earths here in the USA. To further combat inflation, we will not only be reducing the cost of energy, but we'll be ending the flagrant waste of taxpayer dollars. And to that end, I have created the brand new Department of Government Efficiency, GOGE. Perhaps you've heard of it. Perhaps. Which is headed by Elon Musk, who is in the gallery tonight. Thank you, Elon. He's working very hard. He didn't need this. He didn't need this. Thank you very much. We appreciate it. Everybody here, even this side, appreciates it, I believe. They just don't want to admit that. Just listen to some of the appalling waste we have already identified. $22 billion from HHS to provide free housing and cars for illegal aliens. $45 million for diversity, equity, and inclusion scholarships in Burma, $40 million to improve the social and economic inclusion of sedentary migrants. Nobody knows what that is. $8 million to promote LGBTQI+ in the African nation of Lesotho, which nobody has ever heard of. $60 million for indigenous peoples and Afro-Colombian empowerment in Central America, $60 million. $8 million for making mice transgender. This is real. $32 million for a left-wing propaganda operation in Moldova. $10 million for male circumcision in Mozambique. $20 million for the Arab Sesame Street in the Middle East. It's a program, $20 million for a program. $1.9 billion to recently created Decarbonization of Homes Committee, headed up, and we know she's involved. Just at the last moment, the money was passed over by a woman named Stacey Abrams. Have you ever heard of her? A $3.5 million consulting contract for lavish fish monitoring. $1.5 million for voter confidence in Liberia. $14 million for social cohesion in Mali. $59 million for illegal alien hotel rooms in New York City. He's a real estate developer. He's done very well. $250,000 to increase vegan local climate action innovation in Zambia. $42 million for social and behavior change in Uganda. $14 million for improving public procurement in Serbia. $47 million for improving learning outcomes in Asia. Asia's doing very well with learning. You know what we're doing. Should use it ourselves. And $101 million for DEI contracts at the Department of Education, the most ever paid, nothing even like it. Under the Trump administration, all of these scams, and they're far worse, but I didn't think it was appropriate to talk about them. They're so bad. Many more have been found out and exposed and swiftly terminated by a group of very intelligent, mostly young people, headed up by Elon, and we appreciate it. We found hundreds of billions of dollars of fraud. And we've taken back the money and reduced our debt to fight inflation and other things. Taking back a lot of that money. We got it just in time. This is just the beginning. The Government Accountability Office, a federal government office, has estimated annual fraud of over $500 billion in our nation. And we are working very hard to stop it. We're going to. We're also identifying shocking levels of incompetence and probable fraud in the Social Security program for our seniors, and that our seniors and people that we love rely on. Believe it or not, government databases list 4.7 million Social Security members from people aged 100 to 109 years old. It lists 3.6 million people from ages 110 to 119. I don't know any of them. I know some people that are rather elderly, but not quite that elderly. 3.47 million people from ages 120 to 129. 3.9 million people from ages 130 to 139. 3.5 million people from ages 140 to 149. And money is being paid to many of them. And we're searching right now. In fact, Pam, good luck. Good luck. You're going to find it. But a lot of money is paid out to people because it just keeps getting paid and paid and nobody does. And it really hurts Social Security and hurts our country. 1.3 million people from ages 150 to 159 and over 130,000 people, according to the Social Security databases, are age over 160 years old. We have a healthier country than I thought, Bobby. Including, to finish, 1,039 people between the ages of 220 and 229 one person between the age of 240 and 249, and one person is listed at 360 years of age. More than 100 years. More than 100 years older than our country. But we're going to find out where that money's going. And it's not going to be pretty. By slashing all of the fraud, waste, and theft we can find, we will defeat inflation, bring down mortgage rates, lower car payments and grocery prices, protect our seniors, and put more money in the pockets of American families. And today, interest rates took a beautiful drop, big, beautiful drop. It's about time. And in the near future, I want to do what has not been done in 24 years, balance the federal budget. We're going to balance it. With that goal in mind, we have developed in great detail what we are calling the Gold Card, which goes on sale very, very soon. For $5 million, we will allow the most successful job-creating people from all over the world to buy a path to U.S. citizenship. It's like the green card, but better and more sophisticated. And these people will have to pay tax in our country. They won't have to pay tax from where they came. The money that they've made, you wouldn't want to do that, but they have to pay tax, create jobs. They'll also be taking people out of colleges and paying for them so that we can keep them in our country instead of having them being forced out. Number one, at the top school, as an example, being forced out and not being allowed to stay and create tremendous numbers of jobs and great success for a company out there. So while we take out the criminals, killers, traffickers, and child predators who are allowed to enter our country under the open border policy of these people, the Democrats, the Biden administration, the open border insane policies that you've allowed to destroy our country, we will now bring in brilliant, hardworking, job-creating people. They're going to pay a lot of money, and we're going to reduce our debt with that money. Americans have given us a mandate for bold and profound change. For nearly 100 years, the federal bureaucracy has grown until it has crushed our freedoms, ballooned our deficits, and held back America's potential in every possible way. The nation founded by pioneers and risk takers now drowns under millions and millions of pages of regulations and debt. Approvals that should take 10 days to get instead take 10 years, 15 years, and even 20 years before you're rejected. Meanwhile, we have hundreds of thousands of federal workers who have not been showing up to work. My administration will reclaim power from this unaccountable bureaucracy, and we will restore true democracy to America again. Federal bureaucrat who resists this change will be removed from office immediately. Because we are draining the swamp. It's very simple. And the days of rule by unelected bureaucrats are over. And the next phase of our plan to deliver the greatest economy in history is for this Congress to pass tax cuts for everybody. They're in there. They're waiting for you to vote. And I'm sure that the people on my right, I don't mean the Republican right, but my right right here, I'm sure you're going to vote for those tax cuts, because otherwise I don't believe the people will ever vote you into office. So I'm doing you a big favor by telling you that. But I know this group is going to be voting for the tax cuts. Thank you. It's a very, very big part of our plan. We had tremendous success in our first term with it, a very big part of our plan. We're seeking permanent income tax cuts all across the board and to get urgently needed relief to Americans hit especially hard by inflation. I'm calling for no tax on tips, no tax on overtime, and no tax on Social Security benefits for our great seniors. And I also want to make interest payments on car loans tax deductible, but only if the car is made in America. And by the way, we're going to have growth in the auto industry like nobody's ever seen. Plants are opening up all over the place. Deals are being made. Never seen. That's a combination of the election win and tariffs. It's a beautiful word, isn't it? That, along with our other policies, will allow our auto industry to absolutely boom. It's going to boom. Spoke to the majors today, all three, the top people, and they're so excited. In fact, already numerous car companies have announced that they will be building massive automobile plants in America, with Honda just announcing a new plant in Indiana, one of the largest anywhere in the world. And this has taken place since our great victory on November 5th, a date which will hopefully go down as one of the most important in the history of our country. In addition, as part of our tax cuts, we want to cut taxes on domestic production and all manufacturing. And just as we did before, we will provide 100% expensing. It will be retroactive to January 20th, 2025. And it was one of the main reasons why our tax cuts were so successful in our first term, giving us the most successful economy in the history of our country. First term. We had a great first term. If you don't make your product in America, however, under the Trump administration, you will pay a tariff, and in some cases, a rather large one. Other countries have used tariffs against us for decades, and now it's our turn to start using them against those other countries. On average, the European Union, China, Brazil, India, Mexico and Canada, have you heard of them? And countless other nations charge us tremendously higher tariffs than we charge them. It's very unfair. India charges us auto tariffs higher than 100%. China's average tariff on our products is twice what we charge them. And South Korea's average tariff is four times higher. Think of that, four times higher. And we give so much help militarily and in so many other ways to South Korea. But that's what happens. This is happening by friend and foe. This system is not fair to the United States and never was. And so on April 2nd, I wanted to make it April 1st, but I didn't want to be accused of April Fool's Day. Just one day cost us a lot of money. But we're going to do it in April. I'm a very superstitious person. April 2nd, reciprocal tariffs kick in. And whatever they tariff us, other countries, we will tariff them. That's reciprocal, back and forth. Whatever they tax us, we will tax them. If they do non-monetary tariffs to keep us out of their market, then we will do non-monetary barriers to keep them out of our market. There's a lot of that, too. They don't even allow us in their market. We will take in trillions and trillions of dollars and create jobs like we have never seen before. I did it with China, and I did it with others, and the Biden administration couldn't do anything about it because there was so much money, they couldn't do anything about it. We have been ripped off for decades by nearly every country on Earth, and we will not let that happen any longer. Much has been said over the last 3 months about Mexico and Canada, but we have very large deficits with both of them. But even more importantly, they've allowed fentanyl to come into our country at levels never seen before, killing hundreds of thousands of our citizens and many very young, beautiful people, destroying families. Nobody's ever seen anything like it. They are, in effect, receiving subsidies of hundreds of billions of dollars. We pay subsidies to Canada and to Mexico of hundreds of billions of dollars, and the United States will not be doing that any longer. We're not going to do it any longer. Thanks to our America First policies we're putting into place, we have had $1.7 trillion of new investment in America in just the past few weeks. The combination of the election and our economic policies that people of SoftBank, one of the most brilliant anywhere in the world, announced a $200 billion investment. OpenAI and Oracle, Larry Ellison, announced $500 billion investment, which they wouldn't have done if Kamala had won. Apple announced $500 billion investment. Tim Cook called me. He said, I cannot spend it fast enough. It's going to be much higher than that, I believe. They'll be building their plants here instead of in China. And just yesterday, Taiwan Semiconductor, the biggest in the world, most powerful in the world, has a tremendous amount, 97% of the market, announced a $165 billion investment to build the most powerful chips on Earth right here in the USA. And we're not giving them any money. Your CHIPS Act is a horrible, horrible thing. We give hundreds of billions of dollars, and it doesn't mean a thing. They take our money and they don't spend it. All that meant to them, we're giving them no money. All that was important to them was they didn't want to pay the tariff, so they came and they're building, and many other companies are coming. We don't have to give them money. We just want to protect our businesses and our people. And they will come because they won't have to pay tariffs if they build in America. So it's very amazing. You should get rid of the CHIP Act. And whatever's left over, Mr. Speaker, you should use it to reduce debt or any other reason you want to. Our new trade policy will also be great for the American farmer. I love the farmer. Yeah. Who will now be selling into our home market, the USA, because nobody is going to be able to compete with you. Because there's goods that come in from other countries and companies, they're really in a bad position in so many different ways. They're uninspected. They may be very dirty and disgusting, and they come in and they pour in, and they hurt our American farmers. The tariffs will go on agricultural product coming into America, and our farmers, starting on April 2nd, it may be a little bit of an adjustment period. We had that before when I made the deal with China, $50 billion of purchases, and I said, just bear with me, and they did. They did probably have to bear with me again, and this will be even better. That was great. The problem with it was that Biden didn't enforce it. He didn't enforce it. $50 billion of purchases, and we were doing great, but Biden did not enforce it, and it hurt our farmers. But our farmers are going to have a field day right now. So to our farmers, have a lot of fun. I love you, too. I love you, too. It's all going to happen. And I have also imposed a 25% tariff on foreign aluminum, copper, lumber, and steel, because if we don't have, as an example, steel and lots of other things, we don't have a military and, frankly, won't have — we just won't have a country very long. Here today is a proud American steelworker, fantastic person from Decatur, Alabama, Jeff Denard. Has been working at the same steel plant for 27 years in a job that has allowed him to serve as the captain of his local volunteer fire department, raise seven children with his beautiful wife, Nicole, and over the years provide a loving home for more than 40 foster children. So great, Jeff. Thank you, Jeff. Thank you, Jeff. Stories like Jeff's remind us that tariffs are not just about protecting American jobs. They're about protecting the soul of our country. Tariffs are about making America rich again and making America great again, and it's happening, and it will happen rather quickly. There'll be a little disturbance, but we're okay with that. It won't be much. No, you're not. Oh. And look where Biden took us. Very low, the lowest we've ever been. Jeff, I want to thank you very much. And I also want to recognize another person who has devoted herself to foster care community. She worked so hard on it. A very loving person, our magnificent First Lady of the United States. Melania's work has yielded incredible results, helping prepare our nation's future leaders as they enter the workforce. Our First Lady is joined by two impressive young women, very impressive. Haley Ferguson, who benefited from the First Lady's Fostering the Future initiative and is poised to complete her education and become a teacher, and Elliston Berry, who became a victim of an illicit deepfake image produced by a peer. With Elliston's help, the Senate just passed the Take It Down Act. And this is so important. Thank you very much, John. John Thune, thank you. Stand up, John. Thank you, John. Thank you all very much. Thank you. And thank you to John Thune and the Senate. Great job. To criminalize the publication of such images online is terrible, terrible thing. And once it passes the House, I look forward to signing that bill into law. Thank you. And I'm going to use that bill for myself, too, if you don't mind. Because nobody gets treated worse than I do online. Nobody. That's great. Thank you very much to the Senate. Thank you. But if we truly care about protecting Americans' children, no step is more crucial than securing America's borders. Over the past 4 years, 21 million people poured into the United States. Many of them were murderers, human traffickers, gang members, and other criminals from the streets of dangerous cities all throughout the world because of Joe Biden's insane and very dangerous open border policies. They are now strongly embedded in our country, but we are getting them out and getting them out fast. Yeah. And I want to thank Tom Homan and Christy. I want to thank you and Paul of Border Patrol. I want to thank you. What a job they've all done. Everybody, Border Patrol, ICE, law enforcement in general is incredible. We have to take care of our law enforcement. Have to. Last year, a brilliant 22-year-old nursing student named Lakin Riley, the best in her class, admired by everybody, went out for a jog on the campus of the University of Georgia. That morning, Lakin was viciously attacked, assaulted, beaten, brutalized, and horrifically murdered. Lakin was stolen from us by a savage illegal alien gang member who was arrested while trespassing across Biden's open southern border and then set loose into the United States under the heartless policies of that failed administration. It was indeed a failed administration. He had then been arrested and released in a Democrat-run sanctuary city, a disaster, before ending the life of this beautiful young angel. With us this evening are Lakin's beloved mother, Allison, and her sister, Lauren. Last year, I told Lakin's grieving parents that we would ensure their daughter would not have died in vain. That's why the very first bill I signed into law as your 47th president mandates the detention of all dangerous criminal aliens who threaten public safety. It's a very strong, powerful act. It's called the Lakin Riley Act. So Allison and Lauren, America will never, ever forget our beautiful Lakin Hope Riley. Thank you very much. Since taking office, my administration has launched the most sweeping border and immigration crackdown in American history, and we quickly achieved the lowest numbers of illegal border crossers ever recorded. Thank you. The media and our friends in the Democrat Party kept saying we needed new legislation, we must have legislation to secure the border. But it turned out that all we really needed was a new president. Thank you. Joe Biden didn't just open our borders. He flew illegal aliens over them to overwhelm our schools, hospitals, and communities throughout the country. Entire towns like Aurora, Colorado, and Springfield, Ohio, buckled under the weight of the migrant occupation and corruption like nobody's ever seen before. Beautiful towns destroyed. Now, just as I promised in my inaugural address, we are achieving the great liberation of America. But there still is much work to be done. Here tonight is a woman I have gotten to know Alexis Nungari from Houston, wonderful woman. Last June, Alexis's 12-year-old daughter, her precious Jocelyn, walked to a nearby convenience store. She was kidnapped, tied up, assaulted for 2 hours under a bridge, and horrifically murdered. Arrested and charged with this heinous crime are two illegal alien monsters from Venezuela, released into America by the last administration through their ridiculous open border. The death of this beautiful 12-year-old girl and the agony of her mother and family touched our entire nation greatly. Alexis, I promised that we would always remember your daughter, your magnificent daughter, and earlier tonight, I signed an order keeping my word to you. One thing I have learned about Jocelyn is that she loved animals so much. She loved nature. Across Galveston Bay from where Jocelyn lived in Houston, you will find a magnificent national wildlife refuge, a pristine, peaceful, 34,000-acre sanctuary for all of God's creatures on the edge of the Gulf of America. Alexis, moments ago, I formally renamed that refuge in loving memory of your beautiful daughter, Jocelyn. So, Mr. Vice President, if you would, may I have the order? Thank you very much. All three savages charged with Jocelyn and Lakin's murders were members of the Venezuelan prison gang, the toughest gang, they say, in the world, known as Tren de Aragua. 2 weeks ago, I officially designated this gang, along with MS-13 and the bloodthirsty Mexican drug cartels, as foreign terrorist organizations. They are now officially in the same category as ISIS, and that's not good for them. Countless thousands of these terrorists were welcomed into the U.S. by the Biden administration. But now every last one will be rounded up and forcibly removed from our country, or, if they're too dangerous, put in jails, standing trial in this country, because we don't want them to come back ever. With us this evening is a warrior on the front lines of that battle, Border Patrol Agent Roberto Ortiz. Great guy. In January, Roberto and another agent were patrolling by the Rio Grande near an area known as Cartel Island. Doesn't sound too nice to me. When heavily armed gunmen started shooting at them, Roberto saw that his partner was totally exposed, at great danger, and he leapt into action, returning fire and providing crucial seconds for his fellow agent to seek safety, just barely. I have some of the prints of that event, and it was not good. Agent Ortiz, we salute you for your great courage and for your line of fire that you took and for the bravery that you showed. We honor you, and we will always honor you. Thank you, Roberto, very much. Thank you. Thank you, Roberta. And I actually got to know him on my many calls to the border. He's a great, great gentleman. The territory to the immediate south of our border is now dominated entirely by criminal cartels that murder, rape, torture, and exercise total control. They have total control over a whole nation, posing a grave threat to our national security. The cartels are waging war on America, and it's time for America to wage war on the cartels, which we are doing. Five nights ago, Mexican authorities, because of our tariff policies being imposed on them, think of this, handed over to us 29 of the biggest cartel leaders in their country. That has never happened before. They want to make us happy. First time ever. But we need Mexico and Canada to do much more than they've done, and they have to stop the fentanyl and drugs pouring into the USA. They're going to stop it. I have sent Congress a detailed funding request laying out exactly how we will eliminate these threats to protect our homeland and complete the largest deportation operation in American history, larger even than current record holder President Dwight D. Eisenhower, a moderate man, but someone who believed very strongly in borders. Americans expect Congress to send me this funding without delay so I can sign it into law. So, Mr. Speaker, John Thune, both of you, I hope you're going to be able to do that, Mr. Speaker. Thank you. Mr. Leader, thank you. Thank you very much. And let's get it to me. I'll sign it so fast, you won't even believe it. And as we reclaim our sovereignty, we must also bring back law and order to our cities and towns. In recent years, our justice system has been turned upside down by radical left lunatics. Many jurisdictions virtually ceased enforcing the law against dangerous repeat offenders while weaponizing law enforcement against political opponents like me. My administration has acted swiftly and decisively to restore fair, equal, and impartial justice under the constitutional rule of law, starting at the FBI and the DOJ. Pam, good luck. Cash, wherever you may be, good luck. Good luck. Pam Bond. Good luck. So important. Going to do a great job. Cash, thank you. Thank you, Cash. They've already started very strong. They're going to do a fantastic job. You're going to be very proud of them. We're also once again giving our police officers the support, protection, and respect they so dearly deserve. They have to get it. They have such a hard, dangerous job, but we're going to make it less dangerous. The problem is the bad guys don't respect the law, but they're starting to respect it, and they soon will respect it. This also includes our great fire departments throughout the country. Our firemen and women are unbelievable people, and I will never forget them. And besides that, they voted for me in record numbers, so I have no chance. One year ago this month, 31-year-old New York police officer Jonathan Diller, unbelievably wonderful person and a great officer, was gunned down at a traffic stop on Long Island I went to his funeral. The vicious criminal charged with his murder had 21 prior arrests, and they were rough arrests, too. He was a real bad one. The thug in the seat next to him had 14 prior arrests and went by the name of Killer. He was Killer. He killed other people, they say, a lot of them. I attended Officer Diller's service, and when I met his wife and one-year-old son, Ryan, it was very inspirational, actually. His widow's name is Stephanie, and she is here tonight. Stephanie, thank you very much, Stephanie. Thank you very much. Stephanie, we're going to make sure that Ryan knows his dad was a true hero, New York's finest, and we're going to get these cold-blooded killers and repeat offenders off our streets, and we're going to do it fast. Got to stop it. They get out with 28 arrests. They push people into subway trains. They hit people over the head, back of the head with baseball bats. We got to get them out of here. I've already signed an executive order requiring a mandatory death penalty for anyone who murders a police officer. And tonight I'm asking Congress to pass that policy into permanent law. I'm also asking for a new crime bill getting tough on repeat offenders while enhancing protections for America's police officers so they can do their jobs without fear of their lives being totally destroyed. They don't want to be killed. We're not going to let them be killed. Joining us in the gallery tonight is a young man who truly loves our police. His name is DJ Daniel. He is 13 years old, and he has always dreamed of becoming a police officer. But in 2018, DJ was diagnosed with brain cancer. The doctors gave him 5 months at most to live. That was more than 6 years ago. Since that time, DJ and his dad have been on a quest to make his dream come true, and DJ has been sworn in as an honorary law enforcement officer, actually a number of times. The police love him, the police departments love him. And tonight, DJ, we're going to do you the biggest honor of them all. I am asking our new Secret Service Director, Sean Curran, to officially make you an agent of the United States Secret Service. DJ's doctors believe his cancer likely came from a chemical he was exposed to when he was younger. Since 1975, rates of child cancer have increased by more than 40%. Reversing this trend is one of the top priorities for our new presidential commission to make America healthy again, chaired by our new Secretary of Health and Human Services, Robert F. Kennedy, Jr. With the name Kennedy, you would have thought everybody over here would have been cheering. How quickly they forget. Our goal is to get toxins out of our environment, poisons out of our food supply, and keep our children healthy and strong. As an example, not long ago, and you can't even believe these numbers, 1 in 10,000 children had autism, 1 in 10,000. And now it's 1 in 36. There's something wrong. 1 in 36. Think of that. So we're going to find out what it is, and there's nobody better than Bobby and all of the people that are working with you. You have the best to figure out what is going on. Okay, Bobby, good luck. It's a very important job. Thank you. Thank you. My administration is also working to protect our children from toxic ideologies in our schools. A few years ago, January Littlejohn and her husband discovered that their daughter's school had secretly socially transitioned their 13-year-old little girl. Teachers and administrators conspired to deceive January and her husband while encouraging her daughter to use a new name and pronouns. They, them pronoun, actually, all without telling January, who is here tonight and is now a courageous advocate against this form of child abuse. January, thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. Stories like this are why, shortly after taking office, I signed an executive order banning public schools from indoctrinating our children with transgender ideology. I also signed an order to cut off all taxpayer funding to any institution that engages in the sexual mutilation of our youth. And now I want Congress to pass a bill permanently banning and criminalizing sex changes on children and forever ending the lie that any child is trapped in the wrong body. This is a big lie. And our message to every child in America is that you are perfect exactly the way God made you. Because we're getting wokeness out of our schools and out of our military, and it's already out. And it's out of our society. We don't want it. Wokeness is trouble. Wokeness is bad. It's gone. It's gone. And we feel so much better for it, don't we? Don't we feel better? Our service members won't be activists and ideologues. They will be fighters and warriors. They will fight for our country. And Pete, congratulations. Secretary of Defense, congratulations. And he's not big into the woke movement, I can tell you. I know him well. I am pleased to report that in January, the U.S. Army had its single best recruiting month in 15 years, and that all armed services are having among the best recruiting results ever in the history of our services. What a difference. And you know, it was just a few months ago where the results were exactly the opposite. We couldn't recruit anywhere. We couldn't recruit. Now we're having the best results just about that we've ever had. What a tremendous turnaround. It's really a beautiful thing to see. People love our country again. It's very simple. They love our country, and they love being in our military again. So it's a great thing, and thank you very much. Great job. Thank you. We're joined tonight by a young man, Jason Hartley, who knows the weight of that call of duty. Jason's father, grandfather, and great-grandfather all wore the uniform. Jason tragically lost his dad, who was also a Los Angeles County Sheriff's deputy when he was just a boy, and now he wants to carry on the family legacy of service. Jason is a senior in high school, a six-letter varsity athlete, a really good athlete, they say, a brilliant student with a 4.46, that's good, GPA. And his greatest dream is to attend the U.S. Military Academy at West Point. And Jason, that's a very big deal getting in. That's a hard one to get into. But I'm pleased to inform you that your application has been accepted. You will soon be joining the Corps of Cadets. Jason, you're going to be on the long gray line, Jason. As Commander-in-Chief, my focus is on building the most powerful military of the future. As a first step, I'm asking Congress to fund a state-of-the-art Golden Dome missile defense shield to protect our homeland, all made in the USA. Ronald Reagan wanted to do it long ago, but the technology just wasn't there, not even close. But now we have the technology. It's incredible, actually. And other places, they have it. Israel has it. Other places have it. And the United States should have it, too. Right, Tim? Right? They should have it, too. So I want to thank you. But it's a very, very important. This is a very dangerous world. We should have it. We want to be protected, and we're going to protect our citizens like never before. To boost our defense industrial base, we are also going to resurrect the American shipbuilding industry, including commercial shipbuilding and military shipbuilding. And for that purpose, I am announcing tonight that we will create a new Office of Shipbuilding in the White House and offer special tax incentives to bring this industry home to America where it belongs. We used to make so many ships. We don't make them anymore very much, but we're going to make them very fast, very soon. It will have a huge impact. To further enhance our national security, my administration will be reclaiming the Panama Canal, and we've already started doing it. Just today, a large American company announced they are buying both ports around the Panama Canal and lots of other things having to do with the Panama Canal and a couple of other canals. The Panama Canal was built by Americans for Americans, not for others, but others could use it. But it was built at tremendous cost of American blood and treasure. 38,000 workers died building the Panama Canal. They died of malaria. They died of snake bites and mosquitoes. Not a nice place to work. They paid them very highly to go there, knowing there was a 25% chance that they would die. The most expensive project also that was ever built in our country's history, if you bring it up to modern day costs. It was given away by the Carter administration for $1, but that agreement has been violated very severely. We didn't give it to China. We gave it to Panama, and we're taking it back. And we have Marco Rubio in charge. Good luck, Marco. Now, we know who to blame if anything goes wrong. Marco's been amazing, and he's going to do a great job. Think of it. He got 100 votes. You know, he was approved with actually 99, but the 100th was this gentleman, and I feel very certain. So let's assume he got 100 votes. And I'm either very, very happy about that or I'm very concerned about it. But he's already proven. I mean, he's a great gentleman. He's respected by everybody. And we appreciate you voting for Marco. He's going to do a fantastic job. Thank you. Thank you. He's doing a great job. Great job. And I also have a message tonight for the incredible people of Greenland. We strongly support your right to determine your own future. And if you choose, we welcome you into the United States of America. We need Greenland for national security and even international security. And we're working with everybody involved to try and get it. But we need it really for international world security. And I think we're going to get it. One way or the other, we're going to get it. We will keep you safe. We will make you rich, and together we will take Greenland to heights like you have never thought possible before. It's a very small population, but very, very large piece of land and very, very important for military security. America is once again standing strong against the forces of radical Islamic terrorism. 3.5 years ago, ISIS terrorists killed 13 American service members and countless others in the Abbey Gate bombing during the disastrous and incompetent withdrawal from Afghanistan. Not that they were withdrawing. It was the way they withdrew. Perhaps the most embarrassing moment in the history of our country. Tonight, I am pleased to announce that we have just apprehended the top terrorist responsible for that atrocity, and he is right now on his way here to face the swift sword of American justice. And I want to thank especially the government of Pakistan for helping arrest this monster. This was a very momentous day for those 13 families who I actually got to know very well, most of them, whose children were murdered and the many people that were so badly, over 42 people, so badly injured on that fateful day in Afghanistan. What a horrible day. Such incompetence was shown. That when Putin saw what happened, I guess he said, wow, maybe this is my chance. That's how bad it was. Should have never happened. Grossly incompetent people. I spoke to many of the parents and loved ones, and they're all in our hearts tonight. Just spoke to them on the phone. We had a big call. Every one of them called, and everybody was on the line, and they did nothing but cry with happiness. They were very happy, as happy as you can be under those circumstances. Their child, brother, sister, son, daughter was killed for no reason whatsoever. In the Middle East, we're bringing back our hostages from Gaza. In my first term, we achieved one of the most groundbreaking peace agreements in generations, the Abraham Accords. And now we're going to build on that foundation to create a more peaceful and prosperous future for the entire region. A lot of things are happening in the Middle East. People have been talking about that so much lately with everything going on with Ukraine and Russia. But a lot of things are happening in the Middle East. It's a rough neighborhood, actually. I'm also working tirelessly to end the savage conflict in Ukraine. Millions of Ukrainians and Russians have been needlessly killed or wounded in this horrific and brutal conflict with no end in sight. The United States has sent hundreds of billions of dollars to support Ukraine's defense with no security, with no anything. Do you want to keep it going for another 5 years? Yeah, you would say Pocahontas says yes. <laughs> 2,000 people are being killed every single week. More than that. They're Russian young people. They're Ukrainian young people. They're not Americans. But I want it to stop. Meanwhile, Europe has sadly spent more money buying Russian oil and gas than they have spent on defending Ukraine, by far. Think of that. They've spent more buying Russian oil and gas than they have defending. And we've spent perhaps $350 billion, like taking candy from a baby. That's what happened. And they've spent $100 billion. What a difference that is. And we have an ocean separating us, and they don't. But we're getting along very well with them, and lots of good things are happening. Biden has authorized more money in this fight than Europe has spent by billions and billions of dollars. It's hard to believe that they wouldn't have stopped it and said, at some point, come on, let's equalize. You got to be equal to us. But that didn't happen. Earlier today, I received an important letter from President Zelensky of Ukraine. The letter reads, Ukraine is ready to come to the negotiating table as soon as possible to bring lasting peace closer. Nobody wants peace more than the Ukrainians, he said. My team and I stand ready to work under President Trump's strong leadership to get a peace that lasts. We do really value how much America has done to help Ukraine maintain its sovereignty and independence. Regarding the agreement on minerals and security, Ukraine is ready to sign it at any time that is convenient for you. I appreciate that he sent this letter, just got it a little while ago. Simultaneously, we've had serious discussions with Russia and have received strong signals that they are ready for peace. Wouldn't that be beautiful? Wouldn't that be beautiful? Wouldn't that be beautiful? It's time to stop this madness. It's time to halt the killing. It's time to end this senseless war. If you want to end wars, you have to talk to both sides. Nearly 4 years ago, amid rising tensions, a history teacher named Mark Fogel was detained in Russia and sentenced to 14 years in a penal colony. Rough stuff. The previous administration barely lifted a finger to help him. They knew he was innocent, but they had no idea where to begin. But last summer, I promised his 95-year-old mother Malfin that we would bring her boy safely back home. After 22 days in office, I did just that, and they are here tonight. To Mark and his great mom, we are delighted to have you safe and sound and with us. As fate would have it, Mark Fogel was born in a small rural town in Butler, Pennsylvania. Have you heard of it? Where his mother has lived for the past 78 years. I just happened to go there last July 13th for a rally. That was not pleasant. And that is where I met his beautiful mom right before I walked onto that stage. And I told her I would not forget what she said about her son. And I never did I? Never forgot. Less than 10 minutes later, at that same rally, gunfire rang out and a sick and deranged assassin unloaded 8 bullets from his sniper's perch into a crowd of many thousands of people. My life was saved by a fraction of an inch, but some were not so lucky. Corey Comparator was a firefighter, a veteran, a Christian, a husband, a devoted father, and above all, a protector. When the sound of gunshots pierced the air, it was a horrible sound. Corey knew instantly what it was and what to do. He threw himself on top of his wife and daughters and shielded them from the bullets with his own body. Corey was hit really hard. You know the story from there. He sacrificed his life to save theirs. Two others, very fine people, were also seriously hit. But thankfully, with the help of two great country doctors, we thought they were gone and they were saved. So those doctors had great talent. We're joined by Corey's wife, Helen, who was his high school sweetheart, and their two beloved daughters, Allison and Kaylee. Thank you. To Helen, Allison, and Kaylee, Corey is looking down on his three beautiful ladies right now, and he is cheering you on. He loves you. He is cheering you on. Corey was taken from us much too soon, but his destiny was to leave us all with a shining example of the selfless devotion of a true American patriot. It was love like Corey's that built our country, and it's love like Corey's that is going to make our country more majestic than ever before. I believe that my life was saved that day in Butler for a very good reason. I was saved by God to make America great again. I believe that. Thank you very much. From the patriots of Lexington and Concord to the heroes of Gettysburg and Normandy, from the warriors who crossed the Delaware to the trailblazers who climbed the Rockies, and from the legends who soared at Kitty Hawk to the astronauts who touched the moon. Americans have always been the people who defied all odds, transcended all dangers, made the most extraordinary sacrifices, and did whatever it took to defend our children, our country, and our freedom. And as we have seen in this chamber tonight, that same strength, faith, love, and spirit is still alive and thriving in the hearts of the American people. Despite the best efforts of those who would try to censor us, silence us, break us, destroy us, Americans are today a proud, free, sovereign, and independent nation that will always be free, and we will fight for it till death. We will never let anything happen to our beloved country, because we are a country of doers, dreamers, fighters, and survivors. Our ancestors crossed a vast ocean, strode into the unknown wilderness, and carved their fortunes from the rock and soil of a perilous and very dangerous frontier. They chased our destiny across a boundless continent. They built the railroads, laid the highways, and graced the world with American marvels like the Empire State Building, the mighty Hoover Dam, and the towering Golden Gate Bridge. They lit the world with electricity, broke free of the force of gravity, fired up the engines of American industry, vanquished the communists, fascists, and Marxists all over the world, and gave us countless modern wonders sculpted out of iron, glass, and steel. We stand on the shoulders of these pioneers who won and built the modern age. These workers who poured their sweat into the skylines of our cities, these warriors who shed their blood on fields of battle and gave everything they had for our rights and for our freedom. Now it is our time to take up the righteous cause of American liberty, and it is our turn to take America's destiny into our own hands and begin the most thrilling days in the history of our country. This will be our greatest era. With God's help, over the next 4 years, we are going to lead this nation even higher, and we are going to forge the freest, most advanced, most dynamic, and most dominant civilization ever to exist on the face of this earth. We are going to create the highest quality of life, build the safest and wealthiest and healthiest and most vital communities anywhere in the world. We are going to conquer the vast frontiers of science, and we are going to lead humanity into space and plant the American flag on the planet Mars and even far beyond. And through it all, we are going to rediscover the unstoppable power of the American spirit. And we are going to renew unlimited promise of the American dream. Every single day, we will stand up and we will fight, fight, fight for the country our citizens believe in and for the country our people deserve. My fellow Americans, get ready for an incredible future, because the golden age of America has only just begun. It will be like nothing that has ever been seen before. Thank you. God bless you. And God bless America.
If you're just joining us, this has been VOA's special live coverage of President Donald Trump's speech to the joint session of Congress. The president has just finished his speech. He spoke for nearly 2 hours. In a few minutes, we'll have Senator Alyssa Slotkin from the Midwestern state of Michigan giving the Democratic Party's response to the president's speech. Slotkin was elected to the Senate in 2024, having previously served in the U.S. House of Representatives.
And still with us on the phone is Professor Kweku Nuama, a professor, and also Todd Bell, professor and director of George Washington University School of Political Management. Professor Nuama, what is your take out of the president's speech? What did you hear?
Thank you very much. Well, I thought this was a rather long speech. It didn't sound presidential to me. It sounded more like a campaign rally, full of inaccuracies, contradictions, unnecessary exaggerations, partisan shots at Senator Warren, calling her Pocahontas, describing Joe Biden as the worst president ever. Totally unnecessary. And then meandering back to his own personal victimhood, and the list of accomplishments sounded smallish to me. And then promises that I don't think are going to be met. I don't think he's going to balance the budget. And then things like, reclaiming the Panama Canal, renaming the Gulf of Mexico. These are the accomplishments that he put out there. I thought he had some good moments, too. It was interesting, the children that he kept highlighting, the victims' families. And I'm glad that he got applause from Democrats when he mentioned the financial support for Ukraine. But again, this was, for me, it didn't look presidential. It looked more like a campaign event. And it says that he's still probably in campaign mode, and he's not evolving to become the leader that the country needs, the true president for all.
Well, you mentioned the president talk about Ukraine. It seems that the president made news because he said that he has received a letter from Ukrainian President Zelensky, which indicates that maybe they are closer to signing an agreement to begin talking about peace. What do you think?
Well, I think that was always going to be the likely outcome because Ukraine doesn't have any leverage. And it is sad that the United States, which is the remaining hegemon in our system, has to treat an ally like that. Essentially, they brought Zelensky in here to humiliate him, force him to essentially apologize. And this letter that has just come in, this is a last-ditch effort by Zelensky to salvage something out of the relationship. Otherwise, he's probably going to be pushed out by his own people, because they need the United States. There's no way Ukraine wins this war without American support. And Donald Trump knows that. But that's not how you treat your allies. You don't force your allies to beg you to come to their aid, because this fight in Ukraine is not just about Ukraine. It's about the entire Western world collective security system. And so if Ukraine falls, it affects the United States. It affects Europe. It affects a whole bunch of countries who depend on the U.S.-backed collective security system for survival. And so it was humiliating, but I saw this coming. I knew that Zelensky was going to be coming back with an apology and some kind of an olive branch. He probably should have handled himself a little better in the Oval Office as well. And so this was expected. Hopefully, now that Donald Trump has extracted this type of apology and humiliation from him, he lets it go and then realizes that supporting Ukraine in whatever negotiation happens is good for the world, and it's also good for the United States.
Okay, thank you, Professor. Professor Belt, I hope you're still on the line with us. He covered a lot of issues. It was, like I said, a long, long speech. It was nearly 2 hours long. It's probably a record. What stood out to you?
Yes. Well, I think it is a record for sure. I don't think we've ever had one that long, not even close. I think the longest one, other than that, was probably about an hour and 15. So he obviously had a lot he wanted to say, and he wanted to trumpet his accomplishments.
There were a couple of things that stood out to me. His running down the list of how many people who were over 100 years old and receiving Social Security, this has been debunked by a number of different organizations, but this is him trying to show that there is a lot of fraud, waste, and abuse out there. And he talked about some of the grants coming out of USAID to try to turn around some of the public opinion about the moving fast and breaking things that we see Elon Musk doing. The other thing that is a little bit different than you see in most of these events is usually the presidents have what's called a heroes gallery, where they have people who they will point out and they will talk about, you know, the heroic things that they have done.
Right.
Whereas Donald Trump has more of a victims gallery, where he has people who are victims of men playing women's athletics, the Lake and Riley's family, a child with cancer who got, you know, a Secret Service appointment, and others as well. And this really helps to underscore his argument that the world that he inherited from Joe Biden, as he likes to say, is a very violent and dangerous place. He's going to change it into, as he said, the great liberation of America.
Anita's back with us. Anita Powell, our wonderful White House correspondent. Anita, that was quite a long speech. What did you take away from that speech?
That was a made-for-television State of the Union. Of course, it wasn't a State of the Union. It was a joint address to Congress, but that was a made-for-television event. You had everything. You had a lawmaker being ejected 7 minutes in. You had one kid getting into West Point. You had another child just mentioned with cancer who got a Secret Service badge. You had a beaming hostage. You had, and then at the end, you had Trump reminding everybody of his near miss with death and welcoming that victim's family. So it was a very, very evocative performance by Donald Trump. He hit on all of the points that he's made in his past 43 days in office. I did notice that he dug in a little bit on some of the executive orders he signed, calling for them to be codified into law. So this is showing, I think, how he intends to build a legislative agenda off the backs, perhaps, of these executive orders. For example, he called for a bill about transgender children and treatment. It's not clear what the content would be or which of the executive orders he's referring to that he wants this based off of, but that was one. He also called for a codification into law of a move against what he described as, and I want to quote this, illegal alien monsters. That was a very evocative description of what he was, of course, describing as people who've come to the United States without authorization. Illegal alien monsters.
Right. Illegal immigrants. I wrote that one down, too.
And the final thing that really stood out to me that was, can I just say, though, that kid getting the Secret Service badge,
it was kind of a sweet moment.
That was very sweet, the look on his face. And this is part of the magic of the State of the Union address.
Yeah.
These are ordinary Americans. So I just, you know, I just want to say,
and,
like,
you know,
that was
when you bring that up, Anita, it just makes me think that this guy is no one can take away from him the fact that he is a performer and he knows how to reach an audience.
But the other thing that really struck me that I didn't see on the guest list ahead of this was that Elon Musk would be in attendance in the gallery.
Okay.
And he recognized Elon Musk not once, but twice. And I thought that was very, very interesting. And that Elon Musk got more sustained applause from Trump than at any other point in his speech. You see Trump clapping for Elon Musk, whereas I don't think I noticed Trump clapping earlier in the speech. And then my personal favorite moment was where he was talking about waste, fraud, and abuse in government projects. And he mentioned one project in the tiny landlocked African country of Lesotho, which, if memory serves me, he said it correctly, Lesotho. And then he said, a place that nobody knows where that is. And I just loved that he apparently pronounced it correctly, but then said nobody knew where it is.
Nobody, yeah, a country nobody ever heard of before.
That I am pronouncing immaculately.
I wonder if Todd is still there. Todd, I wanted someone to talk about the president. He mentioned something about a gold car. Can someone explain that, please?
I can't. Yes, yes. This is sort of his immigration plus sort of idea, where he, the United States would take a certain amount of money from a person who wants to be U.S., working in the U.S. under a high-level visa, like a tech visa or something. Trump has previously explained it as being something that, like, maybe they're company would pay for, or if they were wealthy, they could pay for it themselves. And it would be like having a green card, but it would have additional benefits. He hasn't really talked about what those were, other than maybe extending the amount of time that you can be here. But he sees it as a way of generating revenue for the U.S. Treasury to help pay for the other things that he'd like to do.
You know, I think it's important to point out, though, Professor Belt, that we're not, he's not the only president that does this, and he is, if at least he's proposing to do it. Other countries do this.
United States does this.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
You can buy EB-5 visa for a maximum investment of about $1 million and creation of 10 jobs will allow you long-term residence in the United States. This visa exists in some form in the United States. This is just a green card on with lots of miles and upgrades, I guess.
Anita, Anita, it seems that the president did not back down when it came to tariffs. And he says if they tax us, we will tax them.
Yep. Huh? That's what he's been very consistent about in his first term, in his language about economic statecraft. He clearly does see economic statecraft as a key tool to managing our relationships with other countries.
You know, I got to say, I was at the RNC. I covered the RNC Professor Belt or Professor Nwamah, you could jump in whenever you want. But I think we're going to the. I'm sorry. I'm going to cut myself off. We're going to go to the Democratic response. She just started.
In between, I worked at the White House under President Bush and President Obama, two very different leaders who both believed that America is exceptional. You can find that same sense of patriotism here in Wyandotte, Michigan, where I'm speaking from tonight. It's a working class town just south of Detroit. President Trump and I both won here in November. It might not seem like it, but plenty of places like this still exist across the United States. Places where people believe that if you work hard and play by the rules, you should do well and your kids should do better. It reminds me of how I grew up. My dad was a lifelong Republican, my mom a lifelong Democrat. But it was never a big deal because we had shared values that were bigger than any one party. We just went through another fraught election season. Americans made it clear that prices are too high and that the government needs to be more responsive to their needs. America wants change, but there's a responsible way to make change and a reckless way. And we can make that change without forgetting who we are as a country and as a democracy. So that's what I'm going to lay out tonight. Because whether you're from Wyandotte or Wichita, most Americans share three core beliefs. That the middle class is the engine of our country, that strong national security protects us from harm, and that our democracy, no matter how messy, is unparalleled and worth fighting for. Let's start with the economy. Michigan literally invented the middle class, the revolutionary idea that you could work at an auto plant and afford the car you were building. That's the American dream. And in order to expand and protect the middle class, we have to do a few basic things. We need to bring down the price of things we spend the most money on, groceries, housing, healthcare. We need to make more things in America with good-paying union jobs and bring our supply chains back home from places like China. We need to give American businesses the certainty they need to invest and create the jobs of the future. And we need a tax system that's fair for people who don't happen to make $1 billion. Look, the president talked a big game on the economy, but it's always important to read the fine print. So, do his plans actually help Americans get ahead? Not even close. President Trump is trying to deliver an unprecedented giveaway to his billionaire friends. He's on the hunt to find trillions of dollars to pass along to the wealthiest in America. And to do that, he's going to make you pay in every part of your life. Grocery and home prices are going up, not down, and he hasn't laid out a credible plan to deal with either of those. His tariffs on allies like Canada will raise prices on energy, lumber, and cars, and start a trade war that will hurt manufacturing and farmers. Your premiums and prescriptions will cost more because the math on his proposals doesn't work without going after your health care. Meanwhile, for those keeping score, the national debt is going up, not down. And if he's not careful, he could walk us right into a recession. And one more thing. In order to pay for his plan, he could very well come after your retirement, the Social Security, Medicare, and VA benefits you worked your whole life to earn. The president claims he won't, but Elon Musk just called Social Security the biggest Ponzi scheme of all time. While we're on the subject of Elon Musk, is there anyone in America who is comfortable with him and his gang of 20-year-olds using their own computer servers to poke through your tax returns, your health information, and your bank accounts? No oversight, no protections against cyber attack, no guardrails on what they do with your private data. We need a more efficient government. You want to cut waste? I'll help you do it. But change doesn't need to be chaotic or make us less safe. The mindless firing of people who work to protect our nuclear weapons, keep our planes from crashing, and conduct the research that finds the cure for cancer, only to rehire them 2 days later? No CEO in America could do that without being summarily fired. Okay, so we've talked about economic security. How about national security? Let's start with the border. As someone who spent my whole career protecting our homeland, every country deserves to know who and what is coming across its border. Period. Democrats and Republicans should all be for that. But securing the border without actually fixing our broken immigration system is dealing with the symptom and not the disease. America is a nation of immigrants. We need a functional system keyed to the needs of our economy that allows vetted people to come and work here legally. So I look forward to the president's plan on that. Because here's the thing. Today's world is deeply interconnected. Migration, cyber threats, AI, environmental destruction, terrorism. One nation cannot face these issues alone. We need friends in all corners, and our safety depends on it. President Trump loves to say peace through strength. That's actually a line he stole from Ronald Reagan. But let me tell you, after the spectacle that just took place in the Oval Office last week, Reagan must be rolling in his grave. We all want an end to the war in Ukraine, but Reagan understood that true strength required America to combine our military and economic might with moral clarity. And that scene in the Oval Office wasn't just a bad episode of reality TV. It summed up Trump's whole approach to the world. He believes in cozying up to dictators like Vladimir Putin and kicking our friends like the Canadians in the teeth. He sees American leadership as merely a series of real estate transactions. As a Cold War kid, I'm thankful it was Reagan and not Trump in office in the 1980s. Trump would have lost us the Cold War. Donald Trump's actions suggest that in his heart, he doesn't believe we're an exceptional nation. He clearly doesn't think we should lead the world. Look, America is not perfect, but I stand with the majority of Americans who believe we are still exceptional, unparalleled. And I would rather have American leadership over Chinese or Russian leadership any day of the week. Because for generations, America has offered something better. Our security and our prosperity, yes, but our democracy, our very system of government, has been the aspiration of the world. And right now, it's at risk. It's at risk when the president decides you can pick and choose what rules you want to follow, when he ignores court orders and the Constitution itself, or when elected leaders stand by and just let it happen. But it's also at risk when the president pits Americans against each other, when he demonizes those who are different and tells certain people they shouldn't be included. Because America is not just a patch of land between two oceans. We are more than that. Generations have fought and died to secure the fundamental rights that define us. Those rights and the fight for them make us who we are. We're a nation of strivers, risk takers, innovators, and we are never satisfied. That is America's superpower. And look, I've lived and worked in many countries. I've seen democracies flicker out. I've seen what life is like when a government is rigged. You can't open a business without paying off a corrupt official. You can't criticize the guys in charge without getting a knock at the door in the middle of the night. So as much as we need to make our government more responsive to our lives today, don't for one moment fool yourself that democracy isn't precious and worth saving. But how do we actually do that? I know a lot of you have been asking that question. First, don't tune out. It's easy to be exhausted, but America needs you now more than ever. If previous generations had not fought for this democracy, where would we be today? Second, hold your elected officials, including me, accountable. Watch how they're voting. Go to town halls and demand they take action. That's as American as apple pie. Third, organize. Pick just one issue you're passionate about and engage. And doom scrolling doesn't count. Join a group that cares about your issue and act. And if you can't find one, start one. Some of the most important movements in our history have come from the bottle up. In closing, we all know that our country is going through something right now. We're not sure what the next day is going to hold, let alone the next decade. But this isn't the first time we've experienced significant and tumultuous change as a country. I'm a student of history, and we've gone through periods of political instability before. And ultimately, we've chosen to keep changing this country for the better. But every single time, we've only gotten through those moments because of two things: engaged citizens and principled leaders. Engaged citizens who do a little bit more than they're used to doing to fight for the things that they care about, and principled leaders who are ready to receive the ball and do something about it. So thank you tonight for caring about your country. Just by watching, you qualify as engaged citizens. And I promise that I and my fellow Democrats will do everything in our power to be the principled leaders that you deserve. Good night, everyone.
That was Senator Elisa Slotkin from the Midwestern state of Michigan giving the Democratic Party's response to President Trump's speech. We still have Professor Nuama. Professor Nuama, what do you think? Do you think that the senator's speech gave any new directions for the Democrats during the coming months?
Well, I don't know if it's a new direction, but I think that she at least identified a target that is reachable, which is the middle class. And she showed them how many of the things that Trump is promising is actually going to hurt them economically. So tariffs, she was able to link the tariffs to the cost of energy going up, probably an increase in the national debt, was able to talk about how Elon Musk's work it threatens their privacy, and how Social Security itself might even be cut. She brought up a little bit something about Ukraine, reminding them of the moral clarity, the values that America cares about. You don't treat your allies badly, Canada, for example, and then reminded them that, you know, Trump himself talking about law and order, he's ignoring the law. And that's important message for the base. So the Democratic base was also important here. And she made references to the need for diversity, the need to protect democracy, and this is where she had the list of things that essentially the prescriptions for the base. You know, don't tune out, and you know, hold elected leaders accountable, organize. And so I thought it was a sensible list. I don't know whether it is enough. It's going to take them a while to find their voice. It's going to take them a while to figure out how to, you know, go at Trump. And a lot of it is going to be dependent on how Trump proceeds. So if we're still waiting for the fallout of the tariffs. So if it goes really bad, for example, Democrats probably don't have to do anything. They just have to wait for things to get really bad. There's an election next year, and that's probably what they're looking at. But I think that it's a good start. She comes across as a moderate from a state where Trump won, but she also won. And so that's the kind of the early Obama coalition. There is no blue America, there's no red America, it's just the United States of America. I thought that it was a sensible way to pitch it, but this is a start. We'll see what happens later. Mm-hmm.
Professor, thank you very much again for spending time with us. We do appreciate it very much.
Thanks for having me.
I'm afraid that's all we have time for, and thanks to our guest, Professor Kweku Nuama of the School of International Service at American University, Professor Todd Belt, Director of George Washington University School of Political Management, also our White House correspondent, Anita Powell, and to my co-host, Carol Van Dam. I'm James Bottis saying, Thank you for tuning to this special edition of Daybreak Africa's live coverage of President Donald Trump's address to the joint session of Congress.
At most to live. That was more than 6 years ago. Since that time, DJ and his dad have been on a quest to make his dream come true, and DJ has been sworn in as an honorary law enforcement officer, actually a number of times. The police love him, the police departments love him. And tonight, DJ, we're going to do you the biggest honor of them all. I am asking our new Secret Service Director, Sean Curran, to officially make you an agent of the United States Secret Service. DJ. DJ's doctors believe his cancer likely came from a chemical he was exposed to when he was younger. Since 1975, rates of child cancer have increased by more than 40%. Reversing this trend is one of the top priorities for our new presidential commission to make America healthy again, chaired by our new Secretary of Health and Human Services, Robert F. Kennedy, Jr. With the name Kennedy, you would have thought everybody over here would have been cheering. How quickly they forget. Our goal is to get toxins out of our environment, poisons out of our food supply, and keep our children healthy and strong. As an example, not long ago, and you can't even believe these numbers, one in 10,000 children had autism. One in